From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, when I was a novice, now we're going way back here, 1971.
Oh.
And I barely knew the difference between AC and DC. And at that time, I thought that AM and single sideband were completely different animals. I know that's hard to understand, but I mean, seriously, that they were completely different modulation formats. They had nothing in common.
Well, they sound very different if you listen to them.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know, the average person on the street or behind the chair in the headphones wouldn't know unless they knew more about how they were generated to know that they were related.
That's right. And it took a couple of years of experience and reading until, voila, I found out that actually they're cousins after a fashion.
Well, they're even closer than that. They're really both different forms of amplitude modulation.
That's right.
The real full carrier amplitude modulation that we know about really represents the first kind of voice transmission that there has been in radio. And although the early transmitters, I think, probably did AM and FM simultaneously, but
yes,
Nobody noticed the FM too much because they didn't have a way to detect it at that point. But it's really been going on for more than 100 years in various ways. And they got better at it later, but so maybe 80 years it's been full carrier, full modulation kind of thing. But they used to do strange things like put a variable resistance carbon microphone in series with the antenna lead and talk into it. And I'm talking about curl your whiskers. I mean, that
yes. Get too close to that one. And yes.
It was not very efficient and didn't work very well. But eventually they got their act together and actually amplitude modulated a carrier 100%, which means they were able to make the carrier go from zero to twice the amplitude, with the result that they put out a reasonably good sounding signal that we used to listen to on our kitchen radios in the old days before we learned about single sideband or CW or anything else.
But when did it become Donald Duck? See, that's where I discovered single sideband. I'm tuning around going, what in the world is this?
Exactly right. And we didn't know about it initially, but I mean, in the 30s, let's say, and I'm not absolutely certain about that, but the phone company was using that technique to frequency division multiplex voice carriers onto a wideband system that they'd run by coaxial cable, not necessarily over radio, although sometimes it got over radio. But that was, they'd stack up a dozen carriers in a, what they'd call a group. And then they'd combine that with, I think, five other groups or four other groups and make a super group. And that would go over microwave or go over coax cable. And that was the way they efficiently multiplexed voice transmissions. So that very same technology. And they had all the same parts. They had balanced modulators, sideband filters, and so forth, so they could make that work. And I think in the 30s, perhaps it was AT&T, used that technology on shortwave radio for voice transmission across the Atlantic. And if you know, before they had good, solid, wideband submarine cables, or maybe even in competition with them over time, because they were very expensive initially, they would send telephone voice channels by shortwave radio using single sideband because it was so much more efficient. So basically, and today still we're using amplitude modulation for a number of things. You run into it in the AM broadcast band, as everyone knows on your car radio. If you ever hit the AM button by mistake, you which is not, well, I guess in some parts of the country, they don't really have FM because of the mountains and so forth.
I still listen to AM broadcast.
Yeah, it's there. And also shortwave broadcast. Now, it used to be when we were starting out that shortwave broadcast bands were filled with international stations from all over the world, and it was fascinating to listen to. They all had broadcasts in multiple languages, so if you were studying a language, you could learn that. Or if you were still working on English, you could listen to English language broadcast. Radio Moscow used to be the strongest signal on the band, including on 40 meters. They would come bounding in. But other stations as well from all over the globe, and it was fascinating to listen to and still is for many people. But unfortunately, many of the governments that were sponsoring that have discovered that internet transmission is much cheaper and reaches more people. And then the other people that still do use shortwave often use digital modes that are more effective and have higher fidelity and so forth. But you still hear, if you look, you still hear medium wave and shortwave broadcast stations from other parts of the world.
Yes.
So it's still going on. Another place it's still in use is for aircraft radio communications.
Oh, yeah.
The 121 megahertz
band. Good point.
They have a particular reason for using that. As you may know, FM, which other services use in the VHF range, tends to capture a signal. The strongest signal will be the one you will hear, and it will wipe out the other ones. And supposedly the reason AM is still used on aircraft is if there's somebody in there who's weak, instead of having a stronger signal capture the channel, you might be able to hear both. So if somebody's saying, hey, you're about to run into me, you might be able to hear him in the presence of a stronger signal, whereas with FM you probably wouldn't.
So good point.
So those are still going. And basically what you end up with in a traditional AM signal, we don't think of it being made this way, but it actually is a modulation process in which you have the full carrier, mm-hmm. and you have it modulated by an audio signal, and you end up with still the full carrier, but you end up with the power from the audio signal making sidebands, one on each side of the carrier. It's very inefficient because the carrier itself has no information associated with it, but it takes up most of the power, and it's full power whether anybody's talking or not. What that works out well for is a system in which you have one transmitter and millions of receivers, as you do in a broadcast system. So what you can have is a very cheap receiver that uses the carrier that comes in off the radio to demodulate the signal and results in very clear, high-fidelity-ish audio that's in perfect phase lock with the carrier because it's coming with the signal. And you trade the very cheap receiver that can do that with the very expensive and inefficient transmitter. So the numbers work out very well if you have one transmitter and a lot of receivers.
That's right.
But if you have the typical ham situation in which you have, or any other point-to-point environment, which you have one transmitter and one receiver communicating, it makes sense to unload some of the expense and inefficiency from the transmitter and put a little more into the receiver and use single sideband. And single sideband, what you do is you say, well, we have in AM, we have two sidebands with identical information and one giant carrier that only conveys frequency and phase information, basically.
Yes.
But takes most of the power and generates most of the heat. So what we do is we'll just send one sideband over the radio. We'll tell the station at the other end what frequency we're on, and they can generate the carrier at the receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be used to demodulate the signal. Now, that implies a much more stable receiver environment and perhaps something that is actually phase-locked to the signal or tightly tied to the signal so that it can demodulate properly. And other functions that are easy in a regular AM receiver, such as automatic gain control with a SETI carrier, have to be done in other means using the information in the sideband itself because that's all it's transmitted. So it's a little more complicated to do a good AGC system with that. So you're putting some of the heavy lifting on the receiver side instead of on the transmitter.
Exactly. Let's take a break, 60 seconds, and we'll be right back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back. And you've been describing, of course, single sideband, but I need to ask a question, Joel. I mean, we both know the answer, but I'd like to hear your explanation. What is the advantage? Why did hams in approximately the 1950s into the 1960s make the transition to single sideband? What was the motivation?
Well, the advantage is it works much better. That's a big advantage.
Yeah.
And it's much more efficient. The fact that it's more efficient not only means you save electricity and save transmitter weight, which is a significant difference. I have a 1950s Viking II AM transmitter, 100-watt carrier AM transmitter, and I'm getting old enough that I can't even carry it over the workbench, which I have to do from time to time. It is so heavy because of all the big transformers from the modulation transformer and the big heavy-duty power transformer. A 100-watt sideband transmitter you can lift up with one hand.
Yeah.
Or two fingers, depending on how
that's
recent
right.
it is. And so that's one reason. But I think more important is it's much more efficient communications-wise. I saw an ad as I was looking, researching a different discussion in 1953, an ad for a central electronics single sideband exciter, one of the very early ones. It was plug-in coils, one band, so forth. Big headline was sideband, 8 times the voice power. Well, there are a lot of ways of calculating this, but basically what it means is instead of putting all the power into your carrier, you put the power into one sideband. And that sideband then can come out much stronger than what you would receive on an AM signal. Plus, at the other end, remember we talked about signal-to-noise ratio. Well, the noise in your receiver is proportional to the bandwidth that you have, that you're using in the receiver. So with a single sideband, the bandwidth is actually somewhat less than half as wide as an AM transmitter because you don't need that part in the middle near the carrier. So you actually have less than half the bandwidth. So that means half the noise. So if you had the same amount of signal, you'd have a 2-to-1 signal-to-noise ratio advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But you actually, because you don't have to put all this power into the carrier, you put it into the sideband, so you get even more. And I don't know if 8 is exactly the right number. It depends on a lot of factors and
yes.
how loud you talk and one thing and another. But it's definitely true that single sideband is much more effective than AM.
But why do I have to run lower sideband on 40 meters?
Well, you don't have to. This is a choice.
But I want to.
Well, you could want to. Keep in mind, again, we're talking early 50s when this started to be
yes.
happening. In those days, 40 meters was there, but it was only a CW band. It was not a phone band. So our phone bands were 80, 20, and 10 meters. 15 meters wasn't a band yet. Maybe 10 meters wasn't working that well due to sunspots. The primary focus in early single sideband work was on 80 and 20 meters. There are lots of ways to generate a single sideband signal, but perhaps the most popular way is to generate the single sideband signal at one frequency and then heterodyne it to another.
Mm-hmm.
A popular early single sideband transmitter architecture, and it stayed with us for a while, was to take advantage of the fact that heterodyning a 9 megahertz signal with a 5 megahertz signal would result in a sum on 14 megahertz, which is the 20 meter band, and a difference of 4 megahertz, which is the top of 80 meters or 75 meters. Now, if one of those frequencies were an SSB signal and the other were a carrier, you could easily make a 2-band single sideband exciter using the same equipment on both sides, using one generating frequency and
mm-hmm.
one, let's say, VFO frequency. If you, this is kind of tricky because if you use a, generate the sideband signal on 5 megahertz and use the VFO 9 to 9.5, you end up with an upper sideband signal from 14 to 14.5 and a lower sideband signal from 4 to 3.5 megahertz. And notice the direction is different.
That's right. Yeah.
Subtracted.
Right.
So that's one way that you sort of ended up with an upper sideband signal on 40, on 20, and a lower sideband signal on 75 or 80 meters by not having to do anything different. And I think that's where it came from. It was just a matter of convenience. Now, nowadays, most transceivers offer upper or lower sideband on any band if you want, but still the common practice is on 80 and 40 meters, typically lower sideband is used. On 20, 15, and 10, it's typically, and 17 and 12 and 6 meters
yes.
and so forth, and 2 meters. It's upper sideband. 60 meters is a little bit of an odd duck in that it actually is required by law, by FCC regulations, that upper sideband be used. And that's because the government, to avoid this confusion, just uses upper sideband everywhere, I think, and they don't have to worry about this. And
so really, the use of lower sideband on 40 meters, 80 meters, 160 meters is a matter of tradition. It's not rule, and it's not technology today.
Absolutely correct, and it's certainly not the law, and some people accuse people of breaking the law, and they aren't. If you want to use upper sideband on 40, you can. In fact, some people do. People with military surplus HF equipment typically runs upper sideband only, because that's what the government
does. That's right.
And you'll hear them occasionally gathered on 40 meters particularly. That's absolutely legal. And one reason for not doing it is it's just confusing. Somebody tries to tune your signal and they, oh, I can't tune them in. Something's wrong with this transmitter. No, it's just you have to switch your switch the other way. So by using the common sideband arrangements that everybody uses, it's much easier to make it work.
When you were talking about shortwave, Joel, it prompted another question that I get from readers from time to time, especially in response to, say, a product review about a software-defined radio or, you know, a similar radio that can receive shortwave broadcasts. Oftentimes, there is a feature in the software that implements what is called synchronous AM reception. It's really a treat to use. The times that I've used it, it makes sometimes a dramatic improvement. But for the benefit of our listeners, can you explain AM synchronous?
I think so. Basically, the usual AM signal uses the carrier that's transmitted to demodulate the sidebands. If the signal is strong and steady, that works very well. But if you have fading, let's say, fading tends to show up in carrier fluctuation as the fade happens. Even though the transmitter or the transmitted carrier is available to the receiver, is to null that out in the receiver and generate your own carrier. And of course, the advantage of that is that it will not fade if it's
right
on the same radio. So what that means is you have your own carrier that you're demodulating with, and that's very easy to use to demodulate one sideband as we typically do on single sideband. It's a little trickier if you have two sidebands and you want to use both of them, because then the phase has to be exactly right between the carrier and the two sidebands. Otherwise, you get a lot of distortion. So synchronous detection uses circuitry in the receiver to phase lock the carrier in the receiver so that it can demodulate properly. And that's what synchronous detection is. And so it works better in the presence of fading or other kinds of signal impairments, because that's not as noticeable if the sidebands fade a little bit. It just sounds like somebody's moving back and forth from the microphone. But if the carrier changes rapidly or even slowly, it can affect the gain of the receiver and all kinds of other things.
Yes.
So you're avoiding that kind of signal impairment by having synchronous detection. It takes a little extra circuitry, though.
Well, Joel, let's go to a question. We have one here from Adrian, VE7 Nancy Zulu, and he asks, I operate a tri-band trapped Yagi for HF. I've had a few ham friends tell me that they would never use traps because they're too lossy. I don't recall seeing any data to substantiate such a claim. Obviously, a monobander is going to have more optimal element spacing, but in the case of a multi-band array, is there a noticeable loss using traps at HF, and is this loss more than one might see using non-trapped multiband arrays? What do you think?
Well, there's no question that a solid conductor full-size Yagi will be more efficient than one with traps. On the other hand, to be equally efficient on multiple bands, let's say your three bands, you would really have to have three Yagis on three separate towers, and that would work a lot better maybe than a trapped Yagi, but it would be very inefficient in terms of costs and so forth. So if you try to do the other thing, which is say, okay, instead of having traps, I'll have multiple Yagis on the same boom, which some people do, that actually can work and avoids any problems with traps, but you have the problems of inefficiency due to coupling between the elements, which, it doesn't have to be a big problem, but it certainly is not optimum either. So, you know, question is, what are the choices you have? If you want a single band antenna and you're only going to, if you're only going to use a multi-band antenna on one band, you're better off with a single band antenna, no question about it. On the other hand, the losses are not that great.
Well, I was wondering about that. I mean, that's for years. Some people say, oh, don't use trap antennas. They're lossy. Is that really true? I mean, how much truth is there in that?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of issues. One is they're definitely a potential failure point. And what happens is things can happen to them. But assuming that no one is living in them, which sometimes happens, you find a spider nest in one, and they explode at some point. Or they get full of water because somebody didn't notice that the drip holes are facing up instead of down, whatever. Most trap losses are easily calculatable and are based on the RF resistance of the trap coils, because most capacitors have relatively low loss compared to inductors. But inductors are made of wire, and they have resistance, and that resistance results in loss. But in that case, the highest band would have no trap loss because it stops at the trap, so none of its energy goes through the trap. The next band has one trap per side, and the lowest band perhaps two. And this trap loss would be somewhat comparable to the loss of a loading coil used to shorten the antenna a bit, which is not too much. I modeled a 2015 and 10 rotary trap dipole with traps using a fairly conservative Q of 100, which means for 200 ohms reactance, we had 2 ohms of resistance. On 20 meters with 2 traps per side, the total length was 27.2 feet compared to 33 without the trap. So that's another advantage of the trap dipole. It can be a little smaller, or the trap Yagi, which is handy. The gain of the full-size 20-meter dipole with no traps was 7.5 dBi. With the traps, which is 2 per side, it was 6.92. So that's about half a dB of loss in a single element with 2 traps on each side. Now, if I, instead of using a trap dipole, and I used a multiband dipole made of interlaced elements, chances are it would be comparable to that. If I change the Q of the traps to 200, which is not unreasonable, the difference, instead of being about half a dB, is about 3/10 of a dB. So that's less than half a dB of loss with both traps in play. And with one trap on each side on 15 meters, it's probably a quarter of a dB. So if you put that in perspective, this is really less loss than you probably have in your feed lines.
Oh, I would, yeah, I would say so, yeah.
So if you're really worried about it, get a better feed line, and that's a heck of a lot less expensive than putting up 3 towers and 3 separate Yagis. And
yes.
3 separate rotators and so forth. So, you know, I guess, is a tri-band trap antenna optimum? No, but it's darn close. I use one, and I've been very happy with it. It provides all the benefits of a Yagi, and if it's a little bit of loss, I mean, half the time I have more gain than I need, and I can get all of its directional properties and so forth. So I think it's a good compromise. There are other ways to do it, which may be equally good compromises, but, you know, no antenna is optimum in all respects.
Would it be fair to say, then, that in Adrian's situation or in any other application of a trap, their lossiness is somewhat overrated? In other words, people worry a bit too much about loss in traps?
I think that's probably true. I think more critical reason to worry about them is that they are a potential failure element, and having things move in and live there or other kinds of problems. You're much more likely to have a problem in a trap, I think, than in 2 pieces of aluminum that are clamped together.
Yeah.
So you're adding potential failure points, and occasionally they do blow up, and they, you know, things can happen. But like anything else, you get what you pay for, and it's a compromise. I think it's a good way to add extra bands without adding extra size things for people to look at.
Exactly. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.